This is Central Time. Our next guest lives a double life. By day, mild-mannered reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Also by day, Little League coach and president of Glendale Little League.
Glendale's youth baseball league has gone viral lately with a sign posted at the ballpark encouraging civil and sporting behavior among the parents. We have a picture of that sign on the Central Time Facebook page.
John Diedrich joins us now. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you start by telling us, John, what that sign says?
It has five different points here. It starts off at the top. It says, please remember, number one, these are kids. Number two, this is a game. Number three, coaches are volunteers. Number four, umpires are human. Five, your child is not being scouted by the Brewers today. Thank you, Glendale Little League.
And what led you and the league to post this?
Some years back, the board were discussing, I think like a lot of youth sports leagues have seen parents who, not just parents, grandparents, other people who come to the field, sometimes managers, coaches, other adults, losing their cool, taking youth sports too seriously, doing things that I think really they regret later. And in the moment, they just kind of lost control. And this sign is a reminder, really, to them and anyone else who come to our park to, you know, keep this in perspective as to what this is all about.
Well, to illustrate, here's a sideline scene from the show The Sopranos. Janice Soprano is watching her kid play soccer.
Don't put up with that, Lizzie! Careful with those elbows, number seven!
Hey, out of bounds! Out of bounds!
Hooray, Lizzie, go! They're just a bunch of losers!
Hey, no negatives, you!
Come on, Pops, charge the ball! Charge it!
Being the Sopranos, violence quickly ensues. But, John, how common is, I mean, maybe this is an exaggeration, or maybe it isn't. How common do we see this kind of behavior?
You know, we haven't had, because I'm familiar and I follow the news around the country, I mean, especially through this process and the sign going around, how really, really ugly it's gotten, where police have been called or, you know, fights break out. We haven't had anything in my time. This will be my third year. This is my third year as president. To that level, but you know, it doesn't have to get to the level of punches being thrown and violence. Because as I tell my parents, you know, I mean, the words that they use, the questioning of calls, whether it be umpires, and our umpires for the most part are children, our older players who go down and then later as they grow older through the league, they will umpire younger games, yelling at kids too. I mean, the kids themselves, the children of these parents. You know, a lot of times they just really will turn away from the sport because of the pressure and really the embarrassment and so forth of, you know, of this yelling that goes on. And then it can be contagious, you know. So you sort of have one side getting the other side of the other team maybe feels like they need to increase their volume. And you know, and pretty soon it's just really a toxic environment.
Well, in your piece that you wrote on this recently, John, you talk about the Positive Coaching Alliance as a good approach. And I want to play a clip from a video from that organization. This features young athletes and legendary NBA coach Phil Jackson.
You're teaching me to hate this game.
You're teaching me that if I don't win,
I'm a loser.
You are teaching me
to disrespect officials,
to bend the rules,
to show no respect for my opponents.
You are teaching me to win at all costs.
70% of kids drop out of sports by the age 13. It's disturbing. Sideline confrontations, coaches losing their cool. What are we teaching our children about the game? And more importantly, about life?
And John, a lot there, but it seems like thinking about what they said there, the big win for a parent, for a kid in sports, is that the kid comes back and plays again next year and sticks with it. How important is that as a factor in considering our behavior as parents on the sideline?
Well, you know, I'm glad you played that. That had a big effect on me when I first heard it, and I play it a lot for people in our league. It's a great organization. It's active here in our area, the Packers and other local figures are very active in that group. They do great work. You know, and one of the you mentioned at the beginning that I've coached as well for a while. This is just about my 10th year coming up on that, doing that. And, you know, at the end of the year, one of the things I always tell the players, I have sort of the end of the year conversation. And, you know, I always tell the players, I said, you know, I have two questions for you. One is, will you play next year? And two, will you play for me? And the experience that you want kids to leave with at the end is not one of being burned out, not hating this, not looking forward to it being over, just being sort of emotionally torn up, but just like, this was really fun. It was competitive. We learned the skills and so forth that are attendant to the game. We learned how to work together, but we had fun. And as long as the fun is on top and it's not too serious, you know, that's going to bring kids back. And it's a really important thing, because also what I tell the players is, it's really not about baseball. It's really not about the sport that you're playing. You know, you're learning lessons of life.
We're talking to John Dietrich, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter, and more relevant to this conversation, president of the Glendale Little League, looking at parental behavior on the sidelines at youth sports.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this on the sidelines? Do you think parents take it too far? Have you maybe crossed the line and maybe regretted it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a bit. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we continue our conversation now with John Dietrich, looking at parents' behavior at youth sporting events. He's the president of Glendale Little League. Their sign calling for better parental manners went viral recently.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been involved in youth sports as an athlete, a parent, a coach, or a referee, have you seen bad behavior on the sidelines? What do you do about it? What should we do about it? What kind of problem do you see with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, on Facebook, we heard from Kevin. Kevin writes that this is, quote, one of the biggest problems for coaches throughout the nation. He's involved with a magazine, Coach and Athletic Director. He says it covers this extensively because of the amount of letters we receive on the subject. No easy fix, he says, but coaches keep trying. So, John, what can your league, what can coaches do to try to rein this in?
Well, and again, as I said at the beginning, it's really parents and parents who are sitting in the stands, I think, have a really tough position. I should say, though, that, again, managers and coaches, we've had problems with them as well. So it's not just, you know, the spectators. But I tell our parents, you have a really tough job, right? You're coming to the game, you know, the love of your life, your kid is out there on the field. And, you know, and your heartstrings are attached to them, and stuff happens, and you don't know what to do, and you just sort of blurt out stuff or yell. And especially if you played the game and, you know, you feel like you know kind of what should happen or what, you know, what should be happening, and you're going to sort of put that out there. I tell our parents, I said, you know, you need to warm up, just like the athletes warm up. You need to warm up emotionally when you come in here. And this isn't just going to be like going to Miller Park. You know, things are going to maybe get, and it sounds crazy to do that, but really, it's the kind of thing that pays dividends. And, you know, the Positive Coaching Alliance, they mentioned some really great tips. One of them is, whenever I coach, I always wear a rubber band on my wrist. And that's from Positive Coaching Alliance. Simple thing. When things get stressful, and it does really for all of us, you just snap that rubber band. Snap yourself back to reality. Remember what this is, what it's about, you know, and really, how do you want to look back on this, say, 5 or 10 years from now? How do you want to remember this moment? Because we have decisions to make right then and there that can really have an effect on our kids, you know, and the whole sport that's going on there.
Now, how about the role of a league? And I'll say, over the years, as a parent, we've had our kids in two different leagues. One had a very, very positive culture, and one really seemed okay with parents being very vocal and very negative on the sidelines. What can people who are, you know, the board and the leadership in a league and organization do to send that kind of message you were just talking about to the parents?
Well, so one thing I do is, other than posting the sign, is I send messages out to our coaches and to the whole parents. The parent-wide or the league-wide message will go to parents here shortly. And it's really stressing at the outset to get ahead of this, to set a standard and a message early about the importance for self-control. I also make it very clear that we're just not going to tolerate this. And if there is a problem, and sometimes I hear from managers who will say, look, I tried to admonish this parent, and it just hasn't worked. So what I say is, you know, just tell me, and I'll come and sit next to them during the game. And I'll make sure that if there are problems that I hear about it firsthand. And if somebody can't control themselves, I'm nice about it at the beginning. Other board members are. But if it becomes a problem, you know, we'll warn people or remove them from the park if necessary.
Now, I'll own up, John. I think I'm not the bad parent yelling negative stuff at the ref or the players ever. But I have been known back in the past before I knew better to, you know, shout out encouraging and helpful advice to my kids or the players. They hate it, I know, and it doesn't help them, I know. So how about rating, and I've gotten better, I just kind of mumble to myself now, but how about, that doesn't seem obviously like a bad thing, still something we should avoid?
Well, it is, because it sort of creates this whole environment of, like, angst, you know, and again, you're not really sure as a parent what to do, so you're going to yell, you know, get in there, hit the ball, you know, throw a strike. I mean, sort of obvious things that, you know, obviously the child is trying to do. But the other thing, though, that is, and parents might not realize this, is that their coach has perhaps given them specific instructions. They no doubt have given them specific instructions that may be contradicted and be confusing when they get up there. And it creates this. And I tell our players, I said, when you're in the box, you know what? You don't have to listen to your parents. You know, when you're in the box, see the ball, hit the ball. And, you know, don't worry about all the stuff that's going on behind you. But I'll tell you, Mike Matheny, who's the coach from the St. Louis Cardinals manager, he was a youth baseball coach for 1 year. He sent this sort of scalding letter to parents before he even took the team. And he said, quote, I always said the only youth baseball team I would take was one of orphans, because you parents are all the problem. And he laid out very strict terms that I think some people find a little extreme. But really, his point was that, you know, we're the coaches, we'll do the coaching, you're just really there to show your support. But all the yelling and so forth, you think that's helping, and it's not only creating confusion, you know, and stressing your child out, maybe embarrassing them, but also just kind of creating this environment of sort of tension and so forth. Though it is interesting when you go to a game and people are quiet. And actually, surprisingly, as we get higher up the level, our crowds get small. Our biggest crowds are 6 to 8 year old games. We get huge crowds at those games, which is funny, you know, it's a machine pitch and so forth. You get up to full baseball, 13 and 14 year olds, and, you know, it's kind of like church on Sunday. It's really quiet. And part of that, though, I think, is that parents have been around for a while, and they're like, all right, I get it now. I didn't get it with machine pitch, but I get it now. I'm just here to soak it in. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to sit back and, you know, enjoy the game.
Well, John, we'll leave it there for now. Good luck. I hope everybody in Glendale Little League has a fun and positive season.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, president of Glendale Little League. You can see the sign that went viral on parental sideline manners with lessons for sports parents. It's on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Congressional Republicans have had their sights set on overturning the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, since it became the law of the land in 2010. However, while the GOP now has a majority in the House and the Senate, lawmakers are having a difficult time repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act.
And as lawmakers work to replace Obamacare, a new sticking point has emerged. The newest bill might remove protections for people with pre-existing conditions, one of the Affordable Care Act's most popular health care reforms. This provision has divided congressional Republicans, with more moderate Republicans against removing those protections and more conservative members of the GOP in favor of the removal.
Donna Friedsam is with us now to talk about the newest version of the Republican health care plan and what it could mean for people with pre-existing conditions. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, President Trump has said that people with pre-existing conditions would be covered under the new Republican health care bill. Critics are saying that the new bill would actually leave those same people vulnerable. So what do we know about the provisions for pre-existing conditions in this new Republican health care bill?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than simply saying that the bill requires or allows that pre-existing conditions would remain covered, because the part about covering pre-existing conditions requires not only that the insurance companies issue the insurance, but that the insurance remains affordable to people who have those conditions. And under the Affordable Care Act, there are provisions that required that the products be issued to people regardless of their health status, and also some rules around rating or pricing the premiums that required that the insurance policies be affordable to people even with those conditions. So under the current American Health Care Act, with the amendments that have been added in the last few weeks, while it retains the provision that has insurance companies offering pre-existing condition policies, it changes the law in that states would be able to waive that, and as well, it would not require the kinds of rating rules that are required under the ACA or Obamacare. So the prices for those policies could be based on whatever the risk the insurance companies determine that they want to assign to an individual. And for all intents and purposes, most analysts believe that that would pretty much price out the people with high-risk conditions from being able to purchase insurance in the individual market.
So let's talk through some of this. So if a state applied for a waiver and they were wanting to be waived out of some of those conditions that were included in the ACA, they would then form a high-risk pool. What do we know about how that would work?
So the concept here is that the people with certain conditions, some high risk and some more common conditions but pre-existing, would be removed from the regular insurance market and move into a high risk pool. Wisconsin and many other states actually had a high risk pool prior to the Affordable Care Act, and it functioned well in some ways, and in other ways didn't meet the need for the population. But the idea is that if we remove the high cost cases from the regular insurance pool, then the prices for the premiums for the regular population that don't have those risks will go down. And that would indeed occur if we weren't having to share risk in the regular insurance market with people that had high risk, high cost conditions. Then people who were younger and healthier would have lower premiums because they're not as much of a risk in that market. At the same time, what we know about the high risk pools is that the ones that have operated in the past did not have sufficient funds to take care of the people that were enrolled in them, and the amount of money that's being contemplated under the current amendments to the AHCA look to be significantly lower than what would be required to take care of the insurance or coverage needs of the high-risk population.
But if the bill went on to the Senate, that amount could be bumped up. But do you think to an amount that would make that keep the premiums at a reasonable level for people who would be in that high-risk pool?
It seems unlikely in that the amount that would be required would be more than double what's currently being contemplated. I don't think that the Senate is currently in the mindset of pursuing the same path that the House is pursuing with regard to the model of separating the high risk into these separately funded pools. There were a number of other issues as well with regard to how the pools operated in the past. They had lifetime caps in coverage and waiting periods for coverage of pre-existing conditions. And of course, that is not something that people are going to want to see going forward. So the question is whether this is really a viable solution for this population. And indeed, if there is the wherewithal to find the more than double up funding that's currently being contemplated and take away the kinds of rules for participation that existed in the past, it may indeed significantly improve the chances for that to provide some kind of relief and then allow the regular insurance pool to operate in a way that reduces premiums for the low-risk population. But it doesn't seem that what's being contemplated right now with the existing amendments is going to achieve that result.
And one of the most popular aspects of the Affordable Care Act has been coverage for pre-existing conditions. How sensitive is this subject?
How sensitive?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that you're seeing the population really respond to this because it is one of the most popular provisions of the Affordable Care Act when it took away the risk that people were facing of becoming uninsurable because of whatever kinds of condition might have developed in their life or in many cases things that people were born with. Where they found themselves unable to attain insurance coverage. Or the other thing that is very common is that people have insurance coverage through their employer, and in those cases, they are not underwritten or they're able to get insurance even with a pre-existing condition, but that they feel that they cannot leave those jobs, or if they lose those jobs, they become essentially uninsurable because they can't find insurance through the individual market. They can only get insurance through a large employer. So the Affordable Care Act was intended in its structure to try to make changes to those concerns. Now, this is not to argue that it fixed everything. Certainly there are things that need to be improved, and that's a whole other discussion, but this is the thing that people did recognize provided a fair amount of relief to people with those concerns. So the estimates range from anywhere from 25 to 50% of the population would have some kind of a pre-existing condition that could be medically underwritten or even subject to being considered a deniable condition if we were to go back to the way things were prior to the ACA.
And there is a cultural conversation about this going on right now. We've heard it talked about on the late night shows, talking about coverage there. On, of course, the news shows, Republican Alabama Representative Mo Brooks spoke with CNN's Jake Tapper this weekend about the health care bill. And here's a little bit of that conversation.
My understanding is, as you just mentioned, this new legislation would allow states to opt out and allow insurance companies to refuse to sell insurance to people with pre-existing conditions as long as there's some setup for them, pools of some sort. Is the president sending a message to Congress to change that provision, or did he not understand what was in the bill?
Well, that's not my understanding of the way the bill has been reframed. My understanding is that it will allow insurance companies to require people who have higher health care costs to contribute more to the insurance pool that helps offset all these costs, thereby reducing the cost to those people who lead good lives, they're healthy, they've done the things to keep their bodies healthy. And right now, those are the people who've done things the right way that are seeing their costs skyrocketing.
And Representative Brooks does go on to say later that there are people with pre-existing conditions that are beyond their control. But what does this kind of conversation say if you take a look at this kind of conversation about maybe the suggestion that people who do the right things don't have pre-existing conditions, and, you know, combined with the conversation going on with say, Jimmy Kimmel talking about his infant born with a pre-existing condition? Where is this taking us?
Well, that certainly does raise a lot of emotional conversation. That was an unfortunate phrasing, to say the least, in suggesting that people are to blame in all or most circumstances for whatever kinds of unfortunate medical conditions they find themselves in. And I can't comment on what the congressman was thinking or contemplating when he framed it in that manner, but certainly this is something all of us can think about, various people in our lives or even ourselves, and what kinds of situations arise, and I think that's why it's so very personal for people. They don't know what might occur if, you know, they're faced with some kind of a diagnosis. But I think that what's really important for people to understand is that, you know, certainly Jimmy Kimmel and his discussion about his newborn son being, you know, faced with a severe heart defect is one thing, or think about people with cancer or very, very dramatic things. But medical underwriting is something that occurs for really run-of-the-mill conditions as well. It occurs for high blood pressure, and it occurs for high cholesterol and things that many, many people have. And the increasing numbers of people who have diabetes now, that is subject to medical underwriting.
What is, real quickly, what is medical underwriting?
I'm sorry. This is, medical underwriting is what the insurance companies do if they have an opportunity to look at somebody's health condition and decide whether to deny the policy or to price the policy based on the risk of the individual rather than the price of the group and sharing the risk across the group. So that's what occurred before the Affordable Care Act, and then the Affordable Care Act removed that possibility and said, no, we're going to rate people based on the risk across a whole community, so you can't take an individual person and price them based on their own individual health conditions. So I would just say there's a long list of conditions that could be subject to this kind of pricing based on an individual's own circumstances. It's not only the most dramatic of conditions that you can think of. And like I say, there are things like sleep apnea, epilepsy, Alzheimer's, a whole range of conditions that would raise this circumstance.
And we'll leave it there. Donna, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Take care.
That was Donna Friedsam, researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. And she was with us today to talk about the newest health care bill currently being discussed in Congress and what it might mean for people with pre-existing conditions.